This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm glad to be here again. We're going to be talking about asteroids, which are really kind of very interesting in several different ways. And I termed it fossils of the solar system. The official definition of a fossil is a remnant, impression, or trace of an organism of past geologic ages that has been preserved in the Earth's crust. Now, of course, we're not talking about asteroids being in the Earth's crust, although sometimes that happens, but rather it's sort of an analogous situation. These are fossils, and we all know these as fossils. The sea creatures, fish, trilobites, and of course Tyrannosaurus rex are all fossils that we see in the Earth. And these also are fossils, but they're fossils of the solar system. These are all asteroids, and we'll get to them in a minute. But basically, they're the same kind of thing. They're leftover remnants of the formation of the solar system, and we can learn a lot from them. So there are three questions. One is, are they a danger to us? And I'll talk about that. Can they be used? And then finally, what can they tell us? So the first thing is, are asteroids a danger, and how do we defend ourselves from asteroids that could hit the Earth and eliminate life as we know it? This is the Sun, and if you go out from the Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, see, Earth is right smack dab in the middle of that ring of near what we call near Earth objects. These are all asteroids and comets that are in our area. Don't get scared yet. How often? So the question then is, oh my God, this must be happening like every day where we're being hit by asteroids. No. How often do Earth impacts happen? So these are rough estimates. If you're talking about a 5 to 10 kilometer large asteroid, that's fairly large, not huge, but fairly large. That happens about every 100 million years. Okay, I think we can survive that. 1 kilometer in size, which is a smaller one, about every 500,000 years. 300 meters, which could take out maybe a continent, maybe not even a continent. A few every 1,000 years, maybe. And then if you're talking about a 20 meter asteroid, which are fairly common, you're talking about every 100 years or so. The last one was something called Tunguska, which happened in the Siberia in 1908. And that was the last time the Earth was really hit by a big enough asteroid to make it, us notice it. There have been near misses sometimes, but none that have really hit us. But if you look at it from this 5 kilometer impactor, there's leftover remnants in Canada, which is a 100 kilometer crater. And same thing in India. And the reason you, and this is about 1 kilometer depression. The reason that you see an asteroid that's 5 kilometers carving out an area of 100 kilometers is because of the fact that it hits with such energy. It's such, at such a speed that there's really a lot of energy. So the most dangerous asteroids are those that we call near Earth objects. We'll get to some of the other asteroids in the solar system a little later. But the near Earth objects are those that are within 100 million miles of Earth. So about as far away as the Sun on either side of us. And in that area, There's about 30,000 asteroids, we estimate. But the potentially hazardous objects are those that are within 4.5 million miles of Earth, so closer in, and bigger than 140 meters. And of those, there's only about 2,300 asteroids. Most of those won't be anywhere near us in the next 100 years. And there's only 17 that are near Earth in the next 100 years. There's one that's supposed to come near Earth in 2029, but we now know that it's not supposed to hit Earth anymore. Originally, there was a small percentage chance of actually hitting Earth. Now we know that's probably not the case. These are the size of asteroids that we're talking about. This is a 1.4 kilometer asteroid. You see that basically it's, and this is sort of a city, I forget which one. I forget, but you see that basically this kind of asteroid would take out at least the city, if not more. A 1.1 kilometer is about this big. Then you get down to one that's less than 100 kilometers at 800 meters or so. And finally, one that's 370 meters, that's about as tall. This is Paris, I just found out. This is about as tall as the Eiffel Tower. But again, its impact would be a lot more than just that thing just being dropped. So we need to know when impacts could occur on human timescales and how big they will be, how bad they will be. So when, like figuring out when an asteroid's going to hit us, comes from finding the object and then determining their orbits, like what's their solar orbit, so that we know when they would intersect with Earth's orbit. How bad comes from measuring the impact energy. And the impact energy is, like any other energy source, is mass times velocity. So how big it is, how much it weighs, times velocity. The velocity comes from orbit, and mass equals density times volume. So really, the impact energy depends strongly on the size of the asteroid. The bigger the asteroid, the bigger the impact, because most have about the same velocity. So what should we do about trying to find out if there are any in our neighborhood? Congress did pass the George E. Brown Survey Act, which stated that NASA should discover 90% of near-Earth objects larger than 140 meters by 2020. Well, NASA has studied this and is in the process of building a telescope that will help us, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But you see, we've gone beyond the 2020 threshold and haven't quite gotten there yet. But we do know that of the 25,000-ish near-Earth asteroids that are greater than 140 meters, only about a third have been found to date. The rest are undiscovered. But we know from the concentration about how many there should be. So Near Earth Object Surveyor is a planetary defense mission, and it's designed to detect, track, and characterize small bodies throughout our solar system. By small bodies, we mean asteroids and comets. Bigger bodies are planets. We're talking about smaller. Near Earth Orbit Surveyor provides information to those who must assess the risks of these impacts to Earth and figure out some mitigation strategies, figure out what we can do to make it not happen. It's optimized for the task of finding and characterizing the risks these potentially hazardous objects pose, both as individual objects as well as populations. And they expect to discover about 300,000 near-Earth objects Remember, only about 2,000 of them are really near Earth. But all of the ones that I showed you in that kind of large belt should be able to be discovered, as well as millions of the main belt asteroids. Those are the ones between Mars and Jupiter that don't pose a risk to us now, but it'll help us understand them. So the Near Earth Orbit Object Surveyor is going to survey at infrared wavelengths. Why infrared? Well, asteroids are intrinsically bright in infrared wavelengths because they give off a lot of heat. But many of the asteroids, in fact, most are dark. So try and find them with a normal telescope and you can't. They're just dark against the dark background of space. But we know that at infrared wavelengths, it can find the ones that are dark as well as the ones that are lit up. The other thing we can do is measure their sizes so we know how much of a risk they pose. Now, the Near Earth Object Surveyor is going to be at some place called the Lagrange Point. Does anybody know what that is? Or a couple people. So the Lagrange point, there are five Lagrange points. And the Lagrange point is where Earth's gravity is matched by the sun's gravity. So if you send a telescope like the James Webb Space Telescope, which we already did, to a Lagrange point, it can orbit that Lagrange point with only a minimal amount of energy expended. So you need not a lot of fuel to keep it orbiting that point. The James Webb Space Telescope is at L2. The Near Earth Object Surveyor will be at L1, so it can pick up asteroids in the area between us and the sun, as well as outside the Earth. Okay. So once you know about the asteroids, like how big they are, where they are, those kinds of things, you got to think about how we can deal with them. The only way of dealing with them is detecting them really early. For example, if you look at the time frame in years, okay, I know many people have seen Armageddon and the other disaster movies where they use a nuclear weapon to destroy the thing. Well, that doesn't work. First of all, I'll show you why in a minute. But the other thing is, to be effective, especially for the larger asteroids, you need at least 20 to 50 years. For kinetic energy, same kind of deal, maybe a little less. Tractors are great, but you need even more time. And the only thing you have where you have less time than a year, which is usually in these disaster movies when they find it, is civil defense, meaning, you know, duck. Which doesn't work too well if you've got a big enough asteroid. So the lead time is the key. Any kind of deflection that NASA actually experimented with this with a comet, any kind of deflection, you need about 20 years out. That's the only time it's feasible. Any force that's applied 20 years before impact could deflect and avoid impact, but like 7 years out, for example, is problematic. In 2019, they did a computer-generated scenario. And they had multiple deflection missions that were launched. Some failed. One of them, for example, the asteroid was deflected. And Denver, which is where it was headed for, was saved. But a big fragment, unfortunately, hit New York City with a 10-megaton blast. Oops, sorry. And that's basically what you're facing. So anything less than 20 years, you're talking about evacuation out of the danger zone is the only thing feasible. Okay, second issue. Can asteroids be used? Turning away from the oh my god-ish, and NASA is working on that, but we don't have anything quite yet. But can asteroids be used? So people have talked about asteroid mining, like for minerals or for water, and I'll talk about water in a little bit. Minerals, it's very complex and very expensive. The asteroid minerals are mostly in metal asteroids, and we'll talk about them. But they contain a lot of iron, nickel, and cobalt. There's two iron, nickel, cobalt asteroids, all metal asteroids that are near Earth. Their total worth of both of them is about $11.65 trillion. Now, that's a lot of money. So, but they're problems. First of all, distance. The average distance is about 200 million miles away. That's about four times the distance it takes to get to Mars. In other words, we get to Mars in 6 to 9 months. You get to one of these asteroids in about 3 to 5 years. So it's not really feasible to go there with a mining expedition back and forth. They also have negligible gravity. Asteroids are not big enough to really generate a gravitational field. And so you don't really, you sort of float above it. You don't really step on it or walk on it. Because if you take a wrong step, you'll shoot yourself off into space. And the other thing is, if you're trying to mine one of these, you have to remember Newton's law, which is for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Astronauts found this out very early on when they tried to do spacewalks, early in the Gemini missions. They would go out and with a wrench and just as an experiment, turn a bolt. What happened? Yeah, the astronaut spun around because the bolt was more well fixed than the astronaut was. And so the astronaut just spun around. So it's not feasible to try and do that in a negligible gravity area. Well, this is the way of overcoming distance. You see this asteroid here, and there is an ion engine attached to it, which has constant acceleration that can bring it from 200 million miles away to Earth, near Earth orbit. So when's that going to happen? Sometime in the distant future, if at all. You're talking about a major undertaking. It would be very expensive. It would be very complex. We do not have the technology yet to be able to do that. I'll tell you that right now. Similarly with providing gravity and doing mining. So here's this asteroid. It has a mining operation on it, but you notice it has these thrusters, and basically you can gear up those thrusters to have the asteroid spin slowly and create gravity. Again, well beyond our technology at the present time. So this is all for the far distant future, maybe 100 years from now. Mining asteroids for water might actually be closer than that, maybe only 10 to 20 years away. But why do it? We have water on Earth. Well, if we want to explore space, bringing everything along with you from Earth is absolutely ludicrous, basically impossible. Think about Lewis and Clark. The Lewis and Clark expedition, if you remember, was 1803. It lasted for not quite 2 years. They had a crew of 45 people. They traveled 8,000 miles going from here all the way up to the Northwest. So think about going out into space and bringing everything with you. Again, it's ludicrous. So some people have come up with the idea of solar thermal mining of asteroids. And they actually tried it with a simulated asteroid. And in its simulation, it was successful. So what does that give us? It gives us water in space, but how does that? Okay, you need water too. But how does that really help us? Well, if you have these tanks of water, and the sunlight's hitting these tanks, it vaporizes the water. The water comes out through a nozzle, and that's thrust. So you can have constant thrust from mining water, from mining asteroids from water out in space. So one company is actually, as I said, experimenting with this. It's called Omnivore, and they have the Omnivore Solar Thermal Thruster. That they're experimenting with. Again, it's not happening today, but it might happen in a not too distant future. Okay. And then the other thing we have to think of is, what are asteroids made of and what can they tell us? NASA has had examination of asteroids over time. Some were meteorites that impacted the Earth. We'll talk about that in a minute. There was a mission called NEAR, which landed on Eros, which was a near-Earth object, in 2001, and explored it. And then Dawn, which arrived in 2007 at Vesta and then orbited Ceres, which are two asteroids in the main belt, in 2015. From all these investigations, we know there are basically three types of asteroids. There's the D type, which is basically a rocky asteroid. These can very easily reach Earth's surface, and sometimes they do. There's a C type, which is carbonaceous or organic asteroids, made up mostly of organic material, some rocky material as well, but a lot of organic material. These usually burn up in the atmosphere because they're much more fragile. And then they're all metal asteroids that we'll talk about, which don't often hit the Earth, but if they do, they penetrate pretty well. So how are asteroids formed? Well, asteroids are formed from smaller pieces. If you look at, this is the sort of protoplasmic nebula, which formed early in the solar system's origins. It was a nebula from a distant star that had probably had either a nova or a supernova. So this is the leftovers of another star. And the sun forms in the middle of it, and then small pieces form from the rest of it. The small pieces get together and aggregate with each other because of gravity. And sometimes they form planets, but sometimes the planets prevent more asteroids from joining them. And so they're leftovers. So these are basically leftover pieces from the formation of the solar system. And the large planets prevent nearby planet formation. Metal asteroids are a little different. These form when a larger body, either a protoplanet, meaning an early planet, or a bigger asteroid, have a collision with each other, and it leaves a core exposed, the iron core at the center. So this is something that would look like what occurred. This also is what occurred when the moon was formed. All the stuff that you see circling, this is the Earth. This is the debris that circled the Earth for a while and then came together and formed the moon. But occasionally it will leave the center of the protoplanet or asteroid unexposed. So NASA has a whole bunch of new missions going to some of the asteroids. One is OSIRIS-REx. It actually went there, and we'll talk about that. And that was a visit to a type C or carbonaceous asteroid. It launched in September of 2016, and the sample actually was returned to Earth in September 2023. There's Lucy, which is a visit to several Jupiter Trojan asteroids. These are asteroids that are in the Lagrange point around Jupiter and follow Jupiter around. That launched in October of 2021. And then Psyche, which is a voyage to a metal asteroid, and that launched in October of 23. So let's talk first about OSIRIS-REx. Its origins were it was developed to return and analyze a sample of a carbonaceous asteroid. So why carbonaceous? Well, first of all, although they make up about a fourth to a third of all near-Earth asteroids, they're less than a 30th of all the meteorites that hit Earth because they're so fragile. So in order to be able to get a real good handle on what they're like, we have to go there. And they're very special. There is one exception, and that was the Winchcombe meteorite, which landed in a driveway in England in February of 2021. It was recovered in pristine condition. There was no contamination. It was dry that day. It so happened. It just hit, and that was it. And so 602 grams of asteroid were collected. And 11% of its weight was extraterrestrial water, not free water, but water bound to different minerals. And also there was carbonaceous material on it, including some amino acids. Ooh, gets better later. So this is the Winchcombe asteroid. It's sitting in a museum, I think, in London. And it was explored and gave the results that I told you. But apart from that, we really need to go there. So that's why we developed OSIRIS-REx, and its target was Bennu, which was an average size. It was about half kilometer in size, so about a quarter of a mile. It's sort of a spheroidal top spinning type of thing. And it gets close to Earth at times, so we could get there without too much trouble. So it went there, the OSIRIS-REx went there and used its spectroscopy to explore what Bennu was made of. What they found first was that Bennu had a history of water. There were hydrated phyllosilicates, carbonates, and magnetite, all of which indicates that at some point this asteroid had water in it or around it. It doesn't anymore, but it did. And then there were organics from another asteroid or just from being in space. And those were a whole bunch of them here. So this was a touch and go experiment. The spacecraft had an arm that came down, would touch the asteroid surface, it'd blow out some nitrogen, and some pebbles and stuff would come into this container. And then the container could be put into another container that's reentry proof. So this is what was expected. You see, touches, blows out the nitrogen, collects the sample, and lifts off, and then puts it into the container. Reality was a lot different. Mush. It went deep into it. Mm-hmm. And not so deep, but it was able to get, instead of the 60 grams of material that was expected, it got 250 grams of material. So about 4 ounces of material, which sounds like not a lot, but in reality, for a probe like this, was a real lot. So this is the container that's put into this reentry proof container that then went back to Earth. It landed in the Utah desert. It was picked up, sent to Johnson Space Center, where it was opened under sterile conditions. And then 25% of it was sent to scientists around the world to investigate it. 75% was kept. And there's 63 different analyses being done on the container, on the material that was brought back. I won't go into all of them, but some of them, including electron microscopy, are very interesting to me. So one of the major hypotheses is, does the sample contain organic compounds that could have influenced the origin of life? Could it even help develop the origin of life? And we'll get to that a little later. Lucy launched in October of 21. This is its launch, and you see it, basically it's a nighttime launch, which was kind of pretty. Lucy, it was named Lucy in honor of the human ancestor fossil that was found in Ethiopia, which was also named Lucy. So you see the connection sort of between our fossils and the fossils of the solar system. These are the Trojan asteroids. This is Jupiter. And you see, these are the two Lagrange points for Jupiter. And so there's a whole passel of asteroids that follow ahead of and behind Jupiter in its orbit. And so the things we want to know are, first of all, planet formation, how planets form. And this hopefully will help us understand that. And these are early asteroids forming in the gaseous disk early in the solar system. And so it may give us that information. It may help us understand what the rocky and icy materials are that make up the gas giants, how they came to be, where and how they formed. Did they move around in the solar system? There's theories that the gas giants formed in the inner part of the solar system and then migrated out. And as they did so, they kicked a lot of things out of the solar system or into deep solar system. And then finally, how did the materials needed for life make it to Earth? you see that basically the way the Trojan asteroids came to be is basically the planets, that is Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, had a lot of asteroids forming around them. Some of them got ejected out of the solar system completely. Some got ejected to orbit like in the main belts, and then some actually got captured by Jupiter as the Trojans. So NASA is going to a total of 6 asteroids in the Trojan belt, in the Trojan asteroid belt. Just to give you an example, don't ask me to pronounce all these places, is you pronounce them correctly. Euribides and Greta. So a lot of these have little moons with them. Palamele with a moon. Lucas, Onas, and then Patroclus and Menoetes. And it's going to be going from one to the other. So you see, it arrives hopefully in August 2027, ends up going until 2033. So it's bouncing from one area to another. Good question. So the red generally indicates more rocky material. The gray is hopefully more carbonaceous material, or vice versa, depending on what the spectroscopy tells us. Lucy was 50 feet tip to tip, very big solar arrays. Why do you need solar arrays like this for? I mean, these are huge. Yeah, it's so far away from the sun. Remember, these are going to asteroids that orbit Jupiter. So this is at Jupiter, which is far away from the sun. So that's as far out as you can use solar arrays. But the solar arrays you have to use are giants when you go there. There happened to be a serendipitous encounter, though, on the way there. Lucy was originally going to pass within about 69,000 kilometers from a main belt asteroid called Dinkanesh. But they figured, what the heck, let's try out our instruments. And it was easy enough in terms of the amount of fuel to go only about, to do a flyby of Dinkanesh and fly by only about 425 kilometers. And so it did. These are some of the other asteroids. You see Gaspra, 12 kilometers, some of the others. Dinkanesh was small by comparison, probably only about the new size, maybe a little bigger. So small, but it gave us an opportunity to see what was there. And Dinkanesh, not only was Dinkanesh had a moon. And not only did Dinkanesh have a moon, but Dinkanesh's moon had a moon. What we're finding, I think, is that a lot of these asteroids are rubble pieces, and a lot of them happen to get attracted to a bigger rubble piece. And so a lot of these have sort of other pieces orbiting them. The next mission is Psyche. And that's a journey to a metal world. Psyche is the largest metal asteroid in the solar system. It's near Earth. It's only about 200 million miles away, only. And it's felt to be, at least hypothesis-wise, the remnant from another planet. Again, this was part of a bigger planet that hit another planet, scraped off all of its crust and mantle, and left with the metal core. So the plan is to travel to Psyche, orbit it, determine if we can indeed, was it once the core of a forming planet, and learn about the formation of other planets in our solar system, including our own. But you see that besides the rest of it, Psyche itself has had asteroid impacts, a couple of big ones. And so this is what's believed, anyway, that a lot of times you have all these pieces aggregating, forming a protoplanet and then eventually forming an actual rocky planet with a core, mantle, and crust. And that's probably how Earth formed out of all these little pieces. It's probably how Mercury, Venus, Mars, along with Earth, all form this way. But sometimes it begins to form on this pathway, but gets hit, leaving the exposed core. As I said, it launched October 13th of 2023. It's going to not arrive there until 2029 because it needs about 3.5 years to get there with a Mars gravity assist. And a Mars gravity assist means that it goes by Mars, and in doing so, it's sort of like a slingshot. It goes by around Mars, comes around, whips around, and goes, and so accelerates further. And basically, if you're going to the outer part of the solar system, you have to have those slingshots to accelerate you. If you're going to the inner part of the solar system, to Venus or Mercury or the Sun, you need to step down the other way in terms of your speed. Once it gets there, it's going to do 4 orbits around Psyche for a total of about 20 months at about an 85 kilometer minimum altitude. And it'll be able to figure out whether Psyche really is part of a core of another planet. The current status is it's out beyond Mars in orbit. It's now further than 190 million miles from Earth. Its current speed is about 84,000 miles per hour. The maximum speed will be 124,000 miles per hour when it turns around and starts slowing so it can orbit Psyche. And the interesting thing is, besides going to Psyche, this is the first time NASA has experimented with an ion thruster. What does that mean? It uses xenon to form an ion, which then it ends up being thrust. So this is the spacecraft. It does have solar panels for its electricity, but it has an ion thruster that looks like this. Now, an ion thruster, does anybody have a coin in their pocket? No? No one has coins. Okay, I'll use this. This is a little bit bigger than a quarter, a little heavier than a quarter. Now, how much thrust do you think this thruster generates? In space. How much thrust does it generate? I mean, for example, the Saturn V rocket that got us to the moon, had the first stage had 7.5 million pounds of thrust. How much did this have? How much? That amount. Now, you say to yourself, how in the world is it going to get all the way to Psyche and accelerate to 125,000 miles per hour? The answer is because it's constant. It's constant acceleration. It's not constant speed. It's constant acceleration. Normally, when we go into space, you have the rockets firing, and that's it. You're done. Then that's the speed you got, unless you do a gravity assist. With this, the ion thruster is constantly accelerating that spacecraft until the midpoint when it turns around and breaks it all the way down to Psyche. Okay. So before we get there, how many people were at my last lecture about astrobiology? Raise your hand. Only a few. Good. Okay. For the few who are here, you can put your finger in your ears and just ignore this. For those of you who are not here, the last time I gave my talk on astrobiology, prepare to have your mind blown. There's a couple of updates about asteroids. There are Japanese spacecraft called Hayabusa 2. Explored this asteroid Ryugu from June 2018 to November 2019. It actually did return a sample of the comet. This was only 5 grams. Remember I said that OSIRIS-REx returned 250 grams. So this was a lot smaller. But there was enough to analyze it. Uracil was recently found in that sample. Now, does everybody know what Uracil is? No? This is Uracil. This is the compound. Uracil makes up one of the nucleotide bases that makes up RNA. Now, we use RNA just to make proteins from DNA. But the thing is, a lot of people believe that RNA was the original genetic material that was used in life. It was a lot easier to develop, and it was a lot easier to be used because it could directly manufacture proteins from it. And then eventually some cell gobbled up the RNA and turned it into basically into the nucleus of the cell, where it's messenger RNA. So it uses that to make proteins from. But this might have been the substance of what original life on Earth looked like. And it was on Ryugu. It gets better. Remember I said that there was examination of the material from Bennu? Originally, we knew there was some carbonaceous material, and there was evidence of water in the past. That's all we knew. But recently, they've been exploring more of the stuff that's on it. Does anybody know what this is?
Yes.
They're amino acids. We need 20 amino acids for us to survive. Those are called the essential amino acids. Okay? I won't go through all of them. But there are 20 of them. On Bennu, there were 14 of these that were present. It gets better. What are these? They're nucleotide bases. Okay. What do I mean by nucleotide bases? What if they're nucleotide bases? Anybody know what this is? That's DNA. Okay. Double-stranded, it's DNA. And those nucleotide bases all were present on Bennu. So, in summary, we know that there are millions of asteroids in the solar system. There's the main belt asteroids between Mars and Jupiter. There's the Trojan asteroids in the same orbit as Jupiter, and the near-Earth objects that are within 100 million miles of Earth. But there are millions of them total. They may be utilized someday as rocket fuel, that is, as thruster fuel, because of the water. And maybe even could be mined sometime in the distant future. They do pose a danger to humanity, again, not now, but sometime in the future. But NASA has plans to try and avoid that danger. And they can give us information about the solar system, not only the formation of the solar system itself, but the formation of how life occurred on Earth and other planets. And the question is, were asteroids similar to Bennu the origin of life on Earth as well as other planets?
Yeah.
Like this, where an asteroid hits warm Earth, warm liquid Earth, and suddenly you have life.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.